came out covered with a fisherman's net, adorned with seashells and fake kelp. She represented the ocean and all that it had to give. Contestant number 3 wore a diver's suit, complete with fins, and presented an ode to the coral. Contestant number 4 wore a flag of the Bahamas and sang a song that I assume was the national anthem. I had no idea what the song was supposed to sound like, although I was quite sure it wasn't supposed to sound like what I was hearing. Contestant number 5, dressed as the sun, wore a yellow leotard complete with a swim cap on which styrofoam rays of sunshine had been glued. She discussed the beautiful weather in the Bahamas, sharing statistics on the number of days of sunshine and inches of rain. The last contestant wore a blue dress and read a poem she had written about the ocean. "You are blue, we love you, what would we do without you?" By the end of that segment, I wished Scotty could beam me up. Instead, the swimsuit competition began. Swimsuit competitions go against everything that is right and decent in this world. We're told that beauty is on the inside and that who we are matters far more than what we look like. But could you please just put on this bikini and walk around on high heels so I can judge your inner beauty? I don't know which was worse, to be a contestant or a judge. I wanted to stand up on the table and tell the girls to take off their high heels and hurl them at the organizers of this event, demanding that the pageant be replaced by a spelling bee. Instead, I just sat there and prayed for the end. For the last part, the deep question segment, the girls had to answer a question drawn out of a hat. What would you do if you were selected as Miss Bahamas? If you could solve one problem, what would it be? I'd been hoping the questions would be more interesting. If you were to design a theme park around the crashed drug plane, what would you call it? Besides turtles, can you think of any other endangered species that we could cut up and fry? Finally, the judges were herded into a small room to discuss the contestants. The former Miss Bahamas, a stunning and intelligent woman, and the only person in the world who could wear a hat with large purple feathers and still look good, reminded us that we needed to pick someone who was articulate, since she felt that this was a major part of the pageant. François and I agreed with her. The Canadian had nothing to say. He apparently could not recall the previous 2 hours. The rest of us decided that the talent competition had not yielded a clear winner. The Canadian nodded. We decided to ignore the swimsuit competition, calling it irrelevant. The Canadian nodded. We then agreed that there was only one articulate contestant, and she should be the winner. The Canadian did not nod again because he had nodded off. We woke him up and went back into the auditorium, where once again we were greeted with cheers and screams and sign waving. Right then and there, I gave up all desire of ever becoming a rock star. It was just too loud. The girl we had selected was undoubtedly the underdog. She was quite overweight, she was the least physically attractive, and she had the smallest cheering section. She was, however, the most articulate. This may have been because she was considerably older than the other contestants and probably a repeater. The crowd's favorite was a girl named Chantal, who was by far the prettiest and the best looking in a bathing suit, but we were looking for depth, not beauty. As soon as the MC appeared, the crowd fell silent. People started huddling close together, anticipating the next opportunity to scream. The MC said a few words about how all the girls are so qualified and how hard it must have been to select just one. To a completely hushed audience, he then announced the runners-up, whom we had pretty much picked at random. There were 3 girls left. Everyone assumed the winner was Chantal. He then announced the winner. I can barely recall the next few moments because I was having a panic attack. The instant the winner's name was announced, everyone screamed, but this was not a joyous scream. This was a bad scream, the kind of scream that is usually emitted by mobs, waving clubs, and leads to eventual inclusion in history books. The audience was chanting, "No way, no way!" Chantal stood on stage crying. The winner and her mother, who looked just like her daughter but more overweight, came and thanked us. "We can't believe it," they said. Neither, apparently, could anybody else. François and I managed to get out of the auditorium, running all the way back to our hotel. "They're going to kill us," I said to François. "That's what you said about the mailboat," François said. We went into our room and started getting ready for bed, although I was quite sure I would not be sleeping much that night. "What's that noise?" I asked François.
"What noise?"
"Listen," I said. We could hear a distinct rumbling that was getting louder and louder. François opened the door, then immediately shut it.
"It's nothing," he said.
François has many talents, but lying is not one of them. By the time I got to the door, I could hear the distinct chanting of a large, angry crowd. "Judges paid off! Judges paid off!" The protest went on well into the night. I could not fall asleep, knowing that if the mobs stormed our dinky hotel room, my only weapon was a collection of conch shells. I tried to imagine how my parents would be contacted to claim our bodies.
"It was a violent incident involving a beauty pageant," they would be told.
It was a long night, during which my husband slept like a log. If I were a rich man. In Abadan, we never had to think about money, not because we were rich, but because the National Iranian Oil Company took care of all our needs. Employees received free, furnished housing. The size and amenities were based on years of experience and education. Plumbing problems, electrical problems, and leaky roofs were fixed free of charge. Schools, doctors, and even buses cost nothing. For entertainment, everyone converged at the local clubhouse for bingo, swimming, movies, and concerts. Except for food, it was all free of charge. The club also held Persian New Year celebrations, Christmas parties, and even an annual bal masque with an award given for best costume. My parents and Aunt Sadira and Uncle Abdullah always dressed up as villagers, and every year they didn't win. In 1957, an employee of the fire department won with his rendition of a spaceship passenger. As an engineer with a graduate degree, my father was entitled to a 3-bedroom house with a huge backyard, complete with a vegetable garden and chickens. Each day, I made my rounds, verifying whether the carrots, corn, radishes, or green beans were ready to eat. Afterward, I checked for insects, keeping track of all the creatures that shared our garden. My mother found my interest in bugs an odd and somewhat disturbing hobby for a little girl. My daughter shares that fascination with things that creep and crawl, and I tell her that a career in entomology awaits her. Our front yard in Abadan was filled with roses, jasmine, and narcissus. Next to the flower beds stood a large covered swing. Early evening, when the stifling heat lifted, we would sit outside on the swing, sipping cherry drinks or Pepsi and eating salted sunflower seeds. Our evenings were often punctuated with the sound of our neighbor's shrill voice, "Jimmy! Jimmy!" Her husband's name was not Jimmy, but Javad. But our neighbor had seen a few too many American movies and had decided to anglicize her husband's name, adding a bit of exoticism to our neck of the woods. Not to be outdone, we acquired a stray dog and named it Jimmy. And this is how, on any given evening, one could hear not one, but two families calling for their respective Jimmy. When we first came to America, not only did we have to adjust to paying for everything, the plumber charges for just looking at the problem, we had to pay with American currency. In 1972, $1 was worth 7 tumans, or 70 reals. This meant that a package of Oscar Mayer bologna cost not $2, but 14 tumans. Tomatoes were not 50 cents per pound, but 3.5 tumans. Nothing could be purchased without an automatic conversion to Iranian currency, followed by the requisite, ooh, that's a lot. Little did we know that what seemed expensive when we first came to America would appear to be a downright bargain after the Iranian Revolution. Political upheaval is rarely good for the economy. In 1979, the value of Iranian currency took a nosedive. $1 eventually was worth 800 tumans, or 8,000 riyals. The $2 package of Oscar Mayer bologna now cost 1,600 tumans, the price of a small Persian rug before the revolution. Even Iranians who used to spend money freely now had to think twice before all purchases. My father has always been a thrifty man, but our financial problems after the revolution thrust him onto a new plane of existence, a universe with the motto, "I'll fix it myself." A white lab coat and stethoscope do not a doctor make, and a dozen trips to the Sears hardware department do not a handyman make. But short of drilling for oil or hunting squirrel, my father came to believe that he could take care of all his family's needs. His engineering background, combined with his Time Life Home Repair and Improvement, a 14-volume set, convinced him that he could address any leak, drip, rattle, or clog. Any objection or doubt we expressed led him to recount the story of how he had built a radio when he was a teenager. When challenged with the point that installing tile is perhaps different from building a radio, he would always reply, "Not really." Strolling through our house, one sees ample evidence of my father's can-do spirit. So what if the hot water comes out of the faucet marked cold? That's nothing compared to what a plumber would have charged to fix the sink. And the duct tape covering the holes in the kitchen wall, who's going to notice those? As for the way the wallpaper in the bathroom doesn't match, let's not get too picky. It's just a bathroom, not a dining room. Should Time Life publish a do-it-yourself guide to medical procedures, my mother and I will be leaving the country. If my father limited his handyman skills to his own humble abode, that would be fine. Unfortunately, Kazem Appleseed insists on sharing his gifts with the rest of us. Having fixed everything in his own house, he has moved on to his children's. My brother Fashid is an executive in a high-tech firm. Unlike our father, Fashid has no problem spending money. He pays someone to wash his car, someone to hem his pants, and someone to clean his house. Not only does he have all his clothes dry cleaned, he pays extra to have his laundry picked up and dropped off at his doorstep. During my parents' last visit to Fashid, our father initiated and completed a small project. After Fashid left for work, Kazem strolled to the hardware store and picked up a few items. He then spent the entire day spackling and painting. After 12 hours at work, my brother returned home to discover a blotchy pattern on all the walls of his 24th floor penthouse. "What is this?" "Try to find a crack or hole," my father challenged him. "I covered them all. There were a lot." "Who asked you to do this?" my brother asked incredulously. "Where did you get this paint? It's an entirely different color from my walls." "It's fine if you don't thank me, but for your information, white paint is white paint," my father replied. Seizing an opportunity to avenge a few of her own home repair memories, my mother chimed in. "I told him not to do it. He didn't listen. He never listens." "Well," my father exclaimed indignantly, preparing us for the aphorism he uses like a maraschino cherry to top off all his unappreciated repair projects, "a man standing next to a river cannot appreciate water." Luckily for my father, we weren't standing next to a river. Someone might have ended up in it. When my husband and I bought a condominium, we invited my parents for a visit. Our home was spanking new, which meant there was nothing to repair. After a few hours, however, my father announced, "You need a medicine cabinet in the bathroom." "We don't need a medicine cabinet in the bathroom," we replied. "I think you do," said my father, sounding undeterred. "We don't need one. We don't want one." My father, like a cat, should not be left indoors for 8 hours. Marking his territory, he purchased and installed a medicine cabinet in our bathroom while my husband and I were at work. Perhaps if it hadn't been hung crooked, François would not have been so upset. During his next visit, my father secretly decided that our bathroom needed towel hooks. Using nails that were too long, my father pierced the door, creating towel hooks on one side, medieval blinding devices on the other. My husband has since taken the situation into his own hands, hiding all our screwdrivers and hammers before my parents' visit. My father has never apologized for any of his handyman missteps, insisting instead that our lack of appreciation stems from deeper issues. If I had charged you $1,000 for spackling and painting, you'd think it looked better, he told Fashid. He regularly tells my mother that her complaints about holes left in walls and mismatched tiles only reveal her desire to impress others, a quality that she needs to change. When my husband complained that the medicine cabinet we never wanted in the first place was crooked, my father replied, "It still holds things." His ability not to apologize for glaring mistakes would have served him well in another venue, perhaps politics. It has taught us never to complain about any problem in the house, lest my father decide to fix it. No matter how inconvenient a household malfunction might be, Kazem can always make it worse, for free. Just as my father cannot envision actually calling a plumber for a clogged sink, he cannot understand why people eat in restaurants. For him, eating out means going to one of his sister's houses, where not only is the food fresh, delicious, and served by people who love him and laugh at his jokes, but there is no bill at the end. Going to a real restaurant with my father always means the same thing. The chicken is $12? Does that mean we get the whole chicken? Let's see. They have 20 tables here, 4 people per table average, each ordering the chicken dish, let's say 3 seatings per evening, multiply that by 800 tumans. Jeez, I should have opened a restaurant. These calculations never include the costs of actually running a restaurant, just the supposed profits. Needless to say, we never dare order drinks with my father, since a $2.50 glass of lemonade, which requires at maximum 3 lemons at 10 cents each, plus a little sugar multiplied by 800 tumans, we always drink water. Tap, of course, since bottled water would most certainly lead to a whole other lecture, beginning with how he grew up drinking the water in Ahvaz and is none the worse for it, and you can multiply that by 800. Like a caterpillar morphing into a butterfly, my father magically transforms into Daddy Warbucks as soon as he sets foot in Iran. This is because in Iran, my father is a millionaire. During their annual visits, he and my mother stay at the former Sheraton in Tehran, a hotel they could have never afforded without a complete devaluation of Iranian currency. Each year, my relatives in Iran, a country whose people are known for hospitality, beg my parents to stay with them. But my father refuses, explaining that staying in a suite is not something he can afford anywhere else. The relatives come and visit him, and he treats them all to lavish restaurant meals, leaving huge tips for all the employees. Once my father accepted that his monthly pension from 33 years of employment with the National Iranian Oil Company would buy him only a few restaurant meals in America, he decided to turn it around and do something good with the money in Iran. Every year, he withdraws the pension and donates it to the needy. He has paid for surgeries, numerous medical treatments, eyeglasses, and medicine. About 10 years ago, he met 3 children who had lost both parents and were living with their elderly grandparents. Every year, he supplies them with clothes, books, and toys. Before his last trip, he asked me if I could give him my laptop for the son. "I'm using it to write a book," I told him. "Give it to me when you're done," my father replied. Last year, he bought desperately needed car parts for a man who makes his living as a driver and who, without his car, would have had no job. The year before, he paid for extensive repairs to a home inhabited by a family of 9. Luckily for them, my father did not have his Time Life series with him. Every year, my father returns to America with a suitcase full of pistachios and a head full of stories. He describes the luxuries of staying in a suite and ordering room service and making sure that the cleaning lady receives the biggest tip of her career. He tells me how odd it is for him to be treated with such fanfare in his own country and how everyone considers him to be such a big shot, all because of a pension that means almost nothing here. After his last trip, I asked him if it was hard to return to America, where he is far from wealthy. But Firuzeh, he said, I'm a rich man in America, too. I just don't have a lot of money. Afterward, Kazem and Nazire Jazoyeri. Since the publication of Funny in Farsi, I am asked one question more than any other. How did your family react to the book? The first person I called when I started writing my memoir was Mrs. Sandberg, my second grade teacher. It may seem odd that I have kept up with her all these years, but I, like malaria, stay in the system forever. Mrs. Sandberg, thankfully, did not ask me, as many people did, who my memoir was about, proving that she knew the meaning of memoir. She also did not ask me the second most common inquiry. What in your life are you writing about? It is true that most people write a memoir after an achievement. I, however, skipped the achievement part and moved straight to the memoir. This is because I truly believe that everyone has a story and everyone's story counts. You don't have to win a Nobel, be a supermodel, or be involved in a scandal to have an interesting story, although any of those things, alone or in combination, would guarantee more media coverage. I am still hoping for either a Nobel or a minor scandal involving me in a non-scandalous way, just enough to get me on the front pages on a slow news day. When I told Mrs. Sandberg that I was writing a book, she was ecstatic, claiming that she always knew that I would do something unique in the world. At this point in the conversation, we were interrupted by some muffled noise in the background. Mrs. Sandberg said that her husband, Art, was claiming that he had been the first to make that prediction. Mrs. Sandberg, in her gentle yet firm second-grade teacher way, reminded Art that no, it indeed had been she who had first seen the glimmer of hope beyond my initial 7 words of English. When the book was published, I sent her a signed copy to my favorite American and immediately received a message on my answering machine. Firuzeh, that was the loveliest, sob sob. I can't describe, sob sob. I'll call you later. My extended biological family, those whose English allowed them to read the book, loved it and agreed that I had very accurately captured the different personalities. Not surprisingly, they also had their comments. My oldest uncle, Mohammad, was very upset that I had not used my maiden name. His reaction was not so much out of pride as because his son had recently opened a plastic surgery office in Southern California, and having our last name on a book could translate into many facelifts. My cousin's wife, Azar, was very upset that I had mentioned one of her sons, Mahan, but not the other, Human. My uncle Nematullah asked that I leave him out of my next book. Instead, he requested that I write about his 2 sons, Ali and Javad, both currently in dental school and single. My mother's English prevented her from reading the book. I did, however, let her know what I had written. She gave me her blessing, but had a few questions. Did you mention that I never left you with a babysitter, even though I could have? Did you mention that I nursed you for over 2 years and how difficult you were to wean? Did you mention how I was always at home when you returned from school, that you never came home to an empty house? Although none of the above made it into the book, any mother who gives her blessing to a memoir that mocks her accent has the right to tell the world that I was a pain to wean. And this brings me to the main character in my book, my father. When I started writing my stories, I had no idea that my father would figure so prominently. Often, I would start a story about myself, and by the time I was finished, it was about my father. How this happened, I do not know. When I first told my parents that I was writing stories about my life, their reaction can be summarized in one word. Oh. This is why I called Mrs. Sandberg first. My parents' reaction, however, must be placed in the context of my past. I am a serial hobbyist. It started in fifth grade when I discovered how to order things from the back of comic books. Most of my purchases, Sea Monkeys being the exception, were under $5, so my father happily wrote the checks. He assumed that my new interest gave me something in common with American kids. It didn't. I just liked receiving packages in the mail. Spyglasses, patches, decals, joke books, an array of cheap, useless paraphernalia gathered dust in my closet. The items never lived up to their descriptions, but that didn't stop me. The U.S. Army, however, did. It all began and ended with a seemingly innocent ad for a free U.S. Army cap. All I had to do was fill out a form with some basic information. I also had to be 18, but that struck me as a minor detail. I simply changed my birth date, and 4 weeks later, I was the proud owner of a U.S. Army cap, adorned with a large American flag. Before I could enjoy my newest acquisition, we started receiving phone calls from recruiters who were interested in talking to me about joining the military. Even though I had lied about my age, my first foray into criminal life was obviously flawed by my having given my correct phone number. My mother feigned ignorance with the callers, which, given her English, was not a far stretch, but these people were not discouraged by a confused immigrant. Finally, after the 10th successive call during dinner time, my father took the phone and explained that I was only 11 and didn't want to join the army as much as I wanted the cap. The recruiter was not happy to hear this and explained to my father that since I had lied to the government, I had technically committed a crime, and that this was very serious, and just this once they would let it go. I was no longer allowed to order anything. My dad did, however, let me keep the cap, seeing no value in throwing away a perfectly good accessory. Several years later, I donated it to the Salvation Army, its memory having been tarnished by the nightmares I experienced every time I looked at it. Had my mother not flushed my Sea Monkeys down the toilet while I was at school, I might never have moved on to my next hobby, sewing. My parents were so thrilled that I had taken up a normal hobby, one that did not involve pushy people making phone calls asking my whereabouts, that they even bought me a sewing machine. I pursued my new hobby with vigor, quickly filling my closet with my own creations. My sewing career reached its nadir with my eighth grade graduation dress, a multi-tiered ruffled creation adorned with yards and yards of eyelet and periwinkle blue and pink satin ribbons. This was topped with a brimmed straw hat bought from JCPenney that I decorated with matching pastel ribbons tied in a bow. 25 years later, my daughter found the dress and asked if she could use it for Halloween. "I can be little Bo Peep," she exclaimed. My sewing career came to an abrupt halt when my cousin Sharokh asked me to hem his pants. His request, coupled with the realization that my clothes were really ugly, ended what could have been a career in fashion design. I sold the sewing machine and moved on to knitting. I learned to knit 3 items, mufflers, booties with decorative pom-poms, and shawls with extensive fringing. What I lacked in variety, I made up for in quantity. I needed gifts for all my relatives, none of whom ever wore them. Granted, Southern California's year-round summer weather is not conducive to the wearing of knit scarves, and the last time anyone wore a fringed shawl, Betsy Ross was still sewing her flag. But still, once the gifts were opened, they were never seen again. This indifferent reaction to my creations choked my woolen muse. I moved on to a whole new hobby involving a recipe for a salty dough that, when baked in the oven for hours, created permanently useless objects perfect for cluttering shelves. I discovered this hobby around the holidays. My friend Lori was using it to make Christmas tree decorations. Faced with the decorative limitations of my Muslim household, I decided to make wreaths for my extended family. Wreaths, I reasoned, added a festive touch without implying that the family had abandoned its native ways and would be roasting a pig in the backyard on the 25th. I increased the recipe exponentially, necessitating the purchase of pounds and pounds of salt and flour. The wisdom of supersizing the tchotchkes came into question as soon as the first wreath emerged from the oven. It weighed 40 pounds. Having already purchased industrial quantities of the ingredients, I felt I had no option but to continue. I mixed, I kneaded, I baked, I painted. 7 days and 7 wreaths later, I was done. The first, second, and third recipients of my holiday cheer showed the same facial expression, bewilderment coupled with lower back strain. The other 4 never received theirs, thanks to my mother, who said, "Don't hand out the rest." With my muse almost choked but still gasping for air, I moved on to my next hobby, baking desserts. Familial intervention stepped in again. "Stop baking, we're getting fat." My photography phase was met with equal glee. "Stop taking our picture." Not appreciative of my candid shots, mom getting out of bed, parents having an argument, dad asleep on the sofa, my parents forced me to turn to nature as a model. 4 rolls of black and white photos of leaves on the ground, and I was ready to move on. My painting phase should have been far more appreciated and nurtured, as evidenced by my skill in the self-portrait that depicted a smiling old woman and was entitled "Me on the Inside." My parents said it didn't look like me. Had Picasso been in my family, he would have ended up an accountant. When engineering is considered exciting, there isn't much room for a painting of a dancing banana, like the one I made for my cousin Ali and never saw again. Mine is a family with 1 successful author, my cousin Mehdi, whose book, Process-Centered Software Engineering Environments, is everyone's favorite, although no one in the family, with the possible exception of Mehdi himself, has read it. With my muse dead and buried, I moved on to college, marriage, and motherhood. This explains why 2 decades after my last hobby, when I announced that I was writing stories, my parents were speechless. When I found an agent, they didn't react. When I got a contract with Random House, they showed no reaction. "You have heard of Random House, haven't you?" I asked. "No," they replied. "It's a very big deal," I told them. 1 month later, I received a phone call from my father, out of breath with excitement. "What's that place called that wants your stories?" he asked. "Random House," I told him. "They're huge," he exclaimed. My father had apparently been watching a Tom and Jerry cartoon with my niece, or the other way around, and one of the characters was reading a book published by Random Mouse. Seeing the publishing house mentioned in a cartoon was a watershed moment. From that day on, my dad was very excited. Daily phone calls ensued. "Make sure you mention that I bought a condo in Newport Beach. Did I ever tell you about the time I flunked a guy even though he offered me a bribe? Do you have 15 minutes? I just remembered a story. The last chapter should be about me." When the stories were finished, I let him read them. He loved them all, except for 1, America, Land of the Free. "That chapter makes me look cheap," he complained. "Enjoying freebies is a universal experience," I assured him. Displaying his usual generosity of spirit, he agreed to let the story stay if it's important to the book. He did complain, however, that he now felt self-conscious at Price Club. "There are no pictures in this book, are there?" The book was completed in the summer of 2002 and was slated for release the following summer. My father did not like this. "If it's finished, why do we have to wait so long?" I explained the marketing process, the publishing seasons, the importance of releasing books during the summer season. After every explanation, my dad wanted to know why they weren't releasing it now. Whenever the Middle East was in the news, which was often, my dad would call. "Call Random House and tell them they are making a big mistake. Your book should be out now." "Who makes these decisions at Random House? Why can't they at least publish it for Christmas? It makes more sense.
6 months before the publication, he called me in the middle of the day, screaming into the phone, "You've sold 1.5 million copies!" I very calmly asked him why he was saying this.
"I went on Amazon and it says sales rank, 1,497,000.
He was still yelling into the receiver.
"Listen, Baba," I said. "The sales rank is where my book is compared to the number one bestseller. 1.5 million is the bottom of the barrel. Plus, given that my book is not even published, why would you think that I would sell any, let alone 1.5 million copies?"
I only heard a tiny, defeated voice on the other end of the line.
Oh.
A few months prior to publication, my book started being reviewed and mentioned on radio and on the internet. This led to a change in ranking. With my book reaching the low 40,000s, my father was ecstatic. He started keeping a journal with the date, the time, and my ranking. Yesterday at 10 in the morning, it was 46,789. Today at 10, it's 42,857. It's going crazy. Of course, when my ranking went in the wrong direction, he got very upset. "What's it doing at 67,432? He asked me at 7:30 in the morning as I was trying to get my kids ready for school. He now has a small notebook filled with what is possibly the world's most useless information. I have tried to discourage him from this newfound hobby, but my dad is undeterred, insisting that he wants to remember this period in his life forever. In his attempts to broaden my father's use of the computer beyond Amazon.com, my brother Fashid taught my father how to look me up on internet search engines. My father has since devoted his retirement years to reading articles about me and tracking all information about my book. "There's a library in Maine that carries your book," he told me one day. "You should call them and thank them." He loves reading reviews, since most have been very kind. Hell, however, hath no fury like my father's for the reviewer who didn't love my book. "Who is Publishers Weekly?" my irate father asked one day. "You need to call them and tell them they don't know anything." When the book was finally published, my father was upset about one thing. "You should have used our last name," he complained. I reminded him that he was the reason I had not. "What did I know?" he said. He and my mother spent the first month after publication going from bookstore to bookstore just looking at the book. I made them promise, however, not to accost any shoppers. For my book tour, I invited my parents to come to Northern California to hear me at my local bookstore. "I will come under one condition," my father said. "Do not introduce us." The entire day before my book signing, my father reminded me that they did not want to be introduced under any circumstances. "Don't worry," I said. "The evening is about me." 10 minutes before getting into the car, my mother said, "I want to be introduced." "Forget it," I said. Over 200 people showed up for the reading. My parents sat in the fourth row. When the store manager introduced me, I glanced at my mother. She was already crying. I never once looked at my father for fear that I would start laughing and never stop. After the reading, someone in the audience asked me how my parents feel about the book. "They loved it," I said, "and were in fact in the audience, but did not want to be introduced. So if you see a man old enough to be my father who looks just like me, it's a coincidence," I added. When the event was over, a crowd gathered around my parents. I could hear my father holding court. "I am going to sue her. I'm going to sue her." On the way home, my mother said that was the best night of her life. My father said he wanted Steve Martin to play him in the movie. When my father found out that I was writing one last story for the paperback, he insisted I add an explanation. He said, "When I went on Bowling for Dollars, every contestant had brought his own bowling ball except for me. I had to use someone else's, and it was much too heavy. That's why I bowled so poorly." "That's okay," I told him. "I won the jackpot with that story."
Thank you. Funny in Farsi by Firouzeh Dumas is an Audible.com original presentation of a Skyboat Road Company production. Read by the author, produced and directed by Stefan Rudnicki. Book copyright 2003, Firouzeh Dumas. Sound recording copyright 2004, Audible.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.